Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes, and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did.
Meanwhile, the other male actor, John Anthony Bailey, who played Cece, he was an American actor and pornographic film actor.
No.
Oh, no.
Want to see my Wonder Bug?
Yeah, shockingly, that was his porn name, Wonder Bug. No.
Oh, my God.
Hello, world. It's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. Whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation whose ideas of military service were formed by Gomer Pyle.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we're counting down the 10 most popular giant puppet shows in the land in a countdown of your favorite shows created by the genius minds of Sid and Marty Croft.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
Don't get left behind. Take a trip with us today. We will lead you to a land of dreams. Broadcast some super shows. They will blow your mind away. When you join us, you'll know why we say
welcome to part two of our tribute to Sid and Marty Croft and their Croft Super Show universe. Last episode was a bonanza of information. So much information.
Yeah.
The Croft universe is weird and wild, and it is oh so 70s with these big foam human-sized puppet things that were neither human nor animal. They were like drug-induced figments of the Croft imagination, and we were the lucky beneficiaries of all that psychedelic creativity. We learned about the Croft brothers and their humble beginnings as marionette enthusiasts, which grew into rated X adult puppet shows that toured all over the world, and then how they circled back to children when they created H.R. Puffin Stuff, launching their careers as mainstays of 1970s and 80s Saturday morning children's programming. They just kept pumping out more shows with these outrageous characters that enthralled us and frightened us all at the same time, and we could not look away. Carolyn took us through a timeline of all of those shows, but we didn't have time to take you deep inside those shows and tell you what they were about. That's what we will do today. And to make it even more fun, we decided to rank them.
Of course we did.
Worst to best. And so we asked you, what was your favorite show created by Sid and Marty Croft? And then we counted your comments, we put them into a countdown machine, and we came up with the top 10 shows from the Croft Super Show universe, according to us, the members of the Pop Culture Preservation Society.
Always.
Because this feels epic. Your opinions about this once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon, it is a phenomenon, seems important. don't check my grammar. There's so much to discuss because this was not like anything any of us had ever seen before or since.
I feel like they're so responsible just for that kind of stereotypical version of the 70s being this giant psychedelic fever dream. Mm-hmm. I think the Crofts had a big hand in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They absolutely did. For children, they took something that was in the adult world and they fed it to children.
Yeah. I read something that said they kind of almost piggybacked on the Yellow Submarine kind of idea from the Beatles, and just kind of that was kind of a children's kind of intro into that kind of a world.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I never knew if Yellow Submarine was for adults or for children. I thought it was for me, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, why you thought it was something for children?
But it's because of, I think, all the cartoon, like, graphics and the cartoonishness of it, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, before we get to our countdown, can I circle back to just something we talked about last week that blew all of our minds?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay. And also, I want to tell you that I got all this information from the Remind Magazine website. Now, Remind Magazine, as you know, the three of us love the print version, and you would too. I promise you all listening, you would too. In fact, they sponsor our podcast because we're such a great fit. And speaking of Remind Magazine and how much you would love the print version, did you know that if you go to remindmagazine.com/pop, you can get a full year of Remind Magazine for just $12.
You're welcome.
That's like two cups of coffee, and you get an entire year of the most fun nostalgia and games and puzzles and posters and cool graphics and fun facts and trivia. Anyway, it's 86% off the cover price, you guys. So anyway,
wow.
They also have a great website. And they have so many articles about different Croft shows and the Crofts and everything. And do you guys remember last week we were all very surprised to learn that Sid and Marty Croft produced a show called Pryor's Place,
which
Richard Pryor's children's show.
Yeah, I mean, when you think Richard Pryor, you probably don't immediately think children's television, correct? Famously foul-mouthed and drug-using comedian. But he got a call from Marty Croft, and Marty thought Richard Pryor was the funniest man in the world, basically, is what this article in Remind Magazine said. And so he had pitched his name during a meeting with some CBS executives. And they said, okay, fine, we'll greenlight it if you can get Pryor to say yes. Well, Marty's like, this was a time in Richard Pryor's life where he was trying to make a lot of changes and he was trying to clean up his act.
Gosh.
And I thought he might just like the idea of doing something for kids, Marty said. And he said he was interested. And he's like, I was kind of shocked by that. But then they developed Pryor's Place, which was sort of a Sesame Street-like live-action show. And it did have occasional puppets. And the soundstage was designed to look like Richard Pryor's hometown of Peoria. You guys, some of the guest stars on Pryor's Place were Lily Tomlin, Henry Winkler, Robin Williams, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Because, of course, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Of course, yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. And they had, it was only 13 episodes, but it basically was like actors and Richard Pryor acting out stories about children's issues like bullying and shoplifting. I was kind of wondering, though, was there like drug use? Because there would be kind of an unreliable narrator situation, right?
Do as they say and not as they do.
I'm glad you guys are sitting down because it was pretty successful. It even won a few daytime Emmys.
What? And I've never heard of
what
it.
What year was this?
This was in 1984.
So we're teenagers. Okay. We're teenagers. Yeah. We're not watching children's television. I'm not watching any television, really.
Well,
I just missed
this. After he burned his head. Or what did he do?
Yeah,
was he caught on fire?
That was Michael Jackson.
Yeah. No, it was a crack pipe.
Oh, that's
right.
Crack blew up his face. Mm-hmm. That's why he was trying to change.
We're not laughing. We're not laughing.
No, that's very serious.
But he would make a joke about that, by the way. He would make plenty of jokes. So we're just honoring his humor.
You might be wondering, well, it was pretty successful ratings-wise. It won some daytime Emmys. Why didn't it keep going? Well, Richard Pryor pulled the plug on the show, and it says in Remind Magazine, for reasons that will remain as mysterious as why he said yes in the first place. You know, I will have to say, I was reading a lot of articles on, you know, in Remind, and the writing is pretty dang funny, too. Okay, and then the last one. Remember, Kristen, last week you were talking, almost comparing just a little bit, the Croft, like H.R. Puff and Stuff type puppets to Grimace and the McDonald puppets.
McCheese. Yes.
Did you know that in 1970, the McDonald's ad execs did approach the Crofts with an intriguing proposition. What if the characters of H.R. Puff and Stuff appeared in a series of commercials for the restaurant?
Oh, my God.
The Crofts were like, yeah, tell us more. And they sent over designs and ideas. But when it came time to pay and actually do it, the McDonald execs said, no, we're canceling the ads. We're not doing it. However, the next year, ads began to air about a place called McDonaldland.
Shut up.
And it was tough.
Oh my God.
Remind Magazine says it was tough not to notice the similarities. It was a fantastical island where human children cavorted with large, bizarre puppets and talking trees, right? It turned out that former employees of the Crofts were involved in that creation of McDonaldland. And then in 1971, the Crofts sued McDonald's, and the case was found in their favor, and Sid and Marty were awarded more than $1 million. Listen to what Marty told Forbes magazine in 2016. So we went to Europe for 2 years and spent it all. And then I love the author of this Remind magazine article. He says, there's no word on whether Freddie the Flute joined them.
Okay, that answer, that's amazing, because when it came out of my mouth, when I said, like, the Grimace or Mayor McCheese, it's almost like I wasn't even, it occurred to me after I said it, like, hey, yeah, that's the only other thing. Like, there was, we said there's no copying, except for that. There's no copying. There are no other shows, there are no other commercials that incorporated those giant foam puppets except McDonald's.
Look at, yeah, Mayor McCheese's head.
It's H.R. Puff.
It's basically H.R. Puff.
He's the mayor.
He's the mayor.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He's the mayor. And the talking trees. Come on.
How were you ever thinking you could pull that off, McDonald's? Come on.
And now I'm kind of bummed for Sid and Marty, because it seems like they should have gotten more than $1 million, or that they should have gotten something in perpetuity.
Recurring. Yes. Recurring.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with you, but let's not forget, too, back in 1974, that was a lot more than it is now.
$1 billion.
You know,
sure.
Yeah. But they sure milked it. It's not like it was an ad campaign that was like for 2 years, you know, how some ad campaigns.
Still,
I mean,
it's still going.
Thing.
And all the merch, like all the McDonald's glassware and the little hand plastic puppets.
And the Happy Meals and the commercials and the birthday parties. And
they basically ripped them off. You could get inside the Grimace. Remember the Grimace cage?
Well, it was the Mayor McCheese.
Oh, was it
the
Mayor
one you're
McCheese
thinking
cage?
Of. Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking
his
of.
His head is what you climb, what you're all in.
It's like the Statue of Liberty. You get in his head.
Anyway, I just thought you guys would find those two facts that I found since we recorded last week pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And where did I find those fun facts?
Remind Magazine.
Remind Magazine.
Thank you to Remind Magazine, by the way, for sponsoring them. It's such a good partnership. I just love this. It really is a good match for us.
Media heaven.
It really is. It really is.
I love it.
Okay, so let's get moving into our countdown. We actually asked you two questions. The first question was, who did you prefer as your Croft Super Show hosts? Did you like Captain Cool and the Kongs, or did you like the Bay City Rollers? And this was so interesting to me because, we'll talk about why in a second, but the winner of, little minor drum roll because it's just a tiny question, the winner by double, 2-1, was Bay City Rollers. Almost everybody said Bay City Rollers. And this does make sense to me because we went from, you know, outrageous characters to heartthrobs from Scotland, right? And I think you pointed out last time too, Carolyn, like maybe we were growing up from the playful things to the more heartthrobby things. And so we were going, the show was changing along with us. We all liked this era better, but it was also when the Croft era was kind of ending. The Croft Super Show had several iterations. It had only 3 seasons, and it sounds like in this 3rd season, when they remade it and then renamed it, the Bay City Rollers show, they were doing that because they were losing they were losing viewers. And yet, we still voted them, the Bay City Rollers, our favorite hosts over Captain Cool and the Kongs.
Well, I mean, they were poster boys, too, by then. You know, everyone had their posters up. So, of course, if you
and we were roller skating to their songs at the roller rink. I mean, they were, it was more than just TV where we were, you know, hanging out with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and if you were a huge, do you think they called them roll? What do you think they call Bay City Rollers fans? Like, rollers?
Oh, there is a word. Oh,
there is.
Yeah, there is. I can't remember what it is.
Well, like, let's just say rollers. But if you were someone like that, and then you knew that they were going to be on TV every Saturday morning, 100%, you were tuning into that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even though the songs by Captain Cool and the Kong were good, those were good songs. Those were written by the Osmonds. I really did like those songs. They were a little bit more outrageous than the Scottish Heartthrobs. They might have been a little too outrageous. They were human, right? Like, the giant puppet things are not human. They're not animals. They're not humans. We don't know what they are. But
shut your mouth.
A Captain Cool and the Kongs were human, but such outrageous humans that it might have been a little off-putting.
It was kind of Ziggy Stardusty.
It was glammy. It was glammy.
The platform shoes and the sequin or the rhinestone stuck to their face.
Yep. And
the
makeup. Lots of glitter in the hair. So much glitter in the hair. But notably, in the second season, Captain Cool and the Kongs dialed it down. There was no more glitter on the face. There was no more paint on the face. Instead, they're just wearing, like, cool 70s threads. And so that had to be in response to children going, I'm scared. It's too much.
Yeah. Saturday morning, September 9th, the Crux Superstar Hour premieres, starring the Bay City Rollers in their first American series. Saturday morning's a great place to be, starting September 9th on NBC.
Okay, so let's start our countdown, our official countdown. Which show did you, the Pop Culture Preservation Society, rank as the most beloved of all in the craft universe? Let's start with the least favorite. In the number 10 spot, in last place, is the show that got negative one votes. negative one votes. It got negative one. What this means is that this show got 0 votes. But there was one commenter who said, anything but this show, as in, do not even talk to me about Horror Hotel. Horror Hotel. She's like, I don't want to talk about it. Horror Hotel starred Witchy Poo from HR Puff and Stuff as a hotelier. And she's at the front desk. She's checking in. I know. It's weird. It's so weird. She's checking in really weird guests in big foam costumes and hilarity ensues. But here's the thing. Witchy Poo was scary. Right? She was not the reason we loved HR Puff and Stuff. She was the reason we feared it. But they give her own show? So I think that was a miss. So Horror Hotel is one of the 15-minute mini episodes on the third season, just the third season of the Croft Super Show, when it was rebranded as the Croft Superstar Hour. Mm. And after just 2 months, the show was struggling. The whole show, not just Horror Hotel, but the whole show was struggling in its time slot on Saturday morning. And I think, Michelle, last time you said that you may not have watched the Croft Super Show because it was up against Looney Tunes. Is that right?
Totally.
Apparently, it was struggling against Looney Tunes. And so they quickly revamped the show, and they renamed it the Bay City Rollers Show, and they dropped Horror Hotel. So another reason it may not have gotten any votes is because no one saw it. It was only on for 2 months. That's 8 Saturdays. It was on for 8 Saturdays. And like a lot of these shows, you may think you've never seen it, but when you see a clip or even a still image of a Witchy Poo behind the front desk checking in guests, you're like, oh, I totally saw that show.
Yeah, as soon as you said that, an image popped into my head.
Exactly.
Of course. I saw that.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that is Horror Hotel. Negative one votes. Okay, so in the number 9 spot is a mega tie. We have a mega tie with all the shows that got 0 votes. There were a handful that got, not one single person said this was my favorite. And those shows were, and a lot of these you're going to be like, I don't know that show, but just please hold. So those shows were The Lost Island, The Lost Saucer, Far Out Space Nuts, Magic Mongo, and Bigfoot and Wild Boy. Almost all of these are from either the third season or some of the second season, but it sounds like when fewer people were watching. So The Lost Island was basically a bunch of characters from across the Croft universe stranded on an island in the Bermuda Triangle. Oh, so 70s. The Bermuda Triangle, like, this is like a drinking game. Whenever you hear something from the 70s, you have to drink. When you hear Bermuda Triangle, you have to drink. So you might think, again, you might think you've never seen this show, but maybe it's just because you were confused about what you were watching, because it starred H.R. Puffin Stuff, Sidney and the Sea Monster, Weenie the Genie from Lidsville, Dr. Shrinker, who's now called Dr. Deathray, and a Slee Stack, all running around the Bermuda Triangle. Zero votes. But so now you can be like, well, maybe I saw it. I mean, I know all those people. You just didn't know you were watching The Lost Island. The next show that got zero votes is called Magic Mongo. That is basically I Dream of Genie with a Boy Genie. Zero votes. Then there's Bigfoot and Wild Boy is something, again, I would have told you I have never seen this. But then I saw a clip of Bigfoot, another emblem of the 70s.
Yes.
Nobody talks about Bigfoot anymore, but we talked about him a lot in the
70s. Oh, we do in Colorado.
Oh, do you?
Oh, lots of Bigfoot.
Or do you call him Sasquatch?
It's Sasquatch. Okay. Yeah, I guess it is Sasquatch.
I thought they were interchangeable. I thought they both were the same thing.
Oh, Brian even has like a sticker. There's like on his Ford Bronco, it's not a sticker he put on. There's actually a metal Sasquatch that comes on the car. But yeah, lots of Bigfoot slash Sasquatch in Colorado.
He lives here. This Bigfoot is basically, it looks like a Wookiee. It's a big Wookiee costume. But I saw a clip of this Bigfoot picking up a big rock and throwing it because he's bionic. And I got so Hoosker Dude. Just this one image of the Wookiee slash Bigfoot throwing the rock.
That actually is Hoosker Dude me a little bit right now.
I think there was also an episode of The Bionic Woman or The $6 Million Man where there was a Bigfoot that they had to fight. So there was a little overlap there. So maybe it was the same Bigfoot. He ran away. He left Wild Boy. And he came over to hang out with
Amy Summers.
And he came
over to $6 Million Land Man.
Yes.
And then you can see him going like, picking the
Land
going,
Man.
Yes.
And he's going in slow motion. I definitely saw that Wookiee throw a rock.
This was a later Croft show too, right?
Yes, it is.
Like, we would have been maybe a little season. Old. Yeah, we would have maybe been.
Well, no, we're still 10.
It's like late
70s.
It's, 1978. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My sister remembers watching it.
Oh, she remembers
Bigfoot
and Wild Boy?
It wasn't her favorite, but she remembers watching it for sure, she said, yeah.
It's that rock. I don't know what it is.
Anyway, maybe.
Zero votes. Nobody won it. And then there are two shows that I think we got mixed up as children. I never knew which was which, and that is Far Out Space Nuts and Lost in Space. Lost Saucer. See, again, we got to work on the titles because I continually call this Lost in Space. And then when I found out there was, and I'm talking about it as a child, that there was like a black and white 60s show called Lost in Space, I'm like, no, that's not it. So Lost Saucer, zero votes. Neither one of them got a single vote. Far Out Space Nuts starred Bob Denver, a.k.a. Gilligan, and some other guy as maintenance guys who accidentally pressed the launch button on a spaceship instead of the lunch button. And then, whoops, they go out, they blast off into space. The Lost Saucer, however, this one hurts my feelings because this was one of my favorites. This, again, I'm saying Lost in Space. The Lost Saucer starred Ruth Buzzy and Jim Nabors as Phi and Fum, who are two time-traveling space aliens from the planet ZR3 in the year 2369, and they accidentally land in 1975 with their Dorse, a half-dog, half-horse that I'm sure drives Carolyn crazy. Because, again, it looks like a Wookiee suit. It looks like a person in a Wookiee suit down on all fours, but they have a horse head. And he barks.
Oh, gosh.
Zero votes.
Let's make this clear, too. It doesn't mean people didn't watch them.
It just means
it wasn't their favorite.
It wasn't their favorite.
The question we asked was, what was your favorite? So I actually would have, if anybody would have said that one of those was their favorite, I would have been, like, really pretty astounded and really admire that person, too. Like, I'm really proud of that person. Like, if your favorite was the Lost Saucer of every Croft show, you've got some
march to your own.
Yeah, you loved it. I mean, those are comedy geniuses right there. Gomer Pyle and Ruth Buzzy.
Yes.
But it could be that again, people didn't know what it was called. And so we asked, do you like the Lost Saucer? And they're like, no. But if you'd said, did you like that thing where Gomer Pyle and Ruth Buzzy were aliens and they had a Dorse? They'd be like, oh, I love that show.
Yeah.
We just didn't know what it was called.
Well, coming in both at number 8 and 7 are two shows that I did not watch, but I don't know why, because I would have loved them.
Oh, yeah,
coming in at number 8 is Dr. Shrinker.
Dr. Shrinker is a madman with an evil mind. I love that.
Very good. Very good. Mm-hmm. We don't even need to put a clip in there, Caroline.
No.
So Dr. Shrinker was a segment during the first season of The Kraft Super Show in 1976. And here's just a quick synopsis for those of you who, like me, did not ever watch this, but now know how much I missed out on. So I know there's those of you listening that are like, what is this one? It is about Brad, BJ, and her brother, Gordy. And they crash land their airplane on an island. And as they make their way to the only house on the island, they meet Dr. Shrinker, who was played by veteran actor Jay Robinson, and his assistant, Hugo, who was played by Kraft favorite Billy Birdie. Well, in an effort to prove that his shrinking ray works, Dr. Shrinker shrinks the three teenagers down to 6 inches. Just 6 inches tall. And then they spend the remainder of the series trying to return to normal size and escape the island. You guys, I actually Googled, is there a connection between the Kraft Brothers show, Dr. Shrinker, and the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which of my favorite. Yes. I love that movie. Mm-hmm. There isn't. Like, I thought maybe they got the, you know.
Coincidence.
I mean, other than the fact that it's sort of the same thing. Yeah. So, but meanwhile, Dr. Shrinker and Hugo want to catch the trio so that they will have physical proof that the ray works for whatever world power wants to buy it. You guys, why didn't they just shrink something else? Like the monkey. Maybe the monkey who was in episode one.
Yeah,
you could have shrunk anything else and said, look, proof. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, to me, when I watched that first episode of Dr. Shrinker last week, it screamed Land of the Lost to me.
The
sets, everything. So they're like trapped in this cave, the three teenagers, and they're tiny. And then like through a hole, instead of Grumpy the T-Rex putting his head through, it's like a blue jay or something, you know, trying to peck at them.
It's the same cave. It's probably the same cave.
It looked like all the same stuff. But anyway, and it said that Dr. Shrinker was perhaps the most notorious of all the Kraft Brothers Saturday morning villains. I would disagree.
And give
that award to Witchy Poo. But no one asked me.
Yeah.
I think scariest, maybe he's the most evil. Let's just say maybe he's the most evil. Well, I guess notorious is the, sort of the same thing. Anyway, listen to this. You guys, I have to tell you really quickly, though, about Jay Robinson, who played Dr. Shrinker, because he has a pretty interesting backstory. So decades before Dr. Shrinker, he was a massive Hollywood star. If you go back and look at like photos of him, he was pretty good looking too. Like all the very black and white, you know, they all look very airbrushed. His most famous role was in the 1953 biblical blockbuster, The Robe, with Richard Burton.
Oh yeah.
That really made him super famous. However, from everything I was able to read, he couldn't take that amount of fame very well, and he spiraled into just booze and drugs, and basically it cost him the better part of a decade, and even landed him in prison for a little short time.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but finally in the late 60s, he turned things around for himself, and he was – do you guys remember in the Bewitched episode, he played Caesar Augustus?
Oh, my gosh,
remember the Bewitched episode, that was Dr. Shrinker.
That little thing around – like the little leaves around his head?
Like an olive wreath or something? Mm-hmm.
And then he played Lord Petri on Star Trek. And then after the 16-episode run of Dr. Shrinker ended, he continued to find work. He was on shows like Cheers and The Nanny. He was in Big Top Pee-wee and Bram Stoker's Dracula. So he turned his life around. And Dr. Shrinker kind of was the gateway then to some other really great roles for him. And we can't quickly, and I know we did last week just a little bit, we can't talk about the world of Sid and Marty Kraft without celebrating Billy Barty.
Oh my God, Billy Barty.
And all of his roles. I mean, he was just in everything and a genius. And Carolyn, you're going to love this fun fact.
Oh, you're gonna love it.
I'm so excited to share this with you. One of the three trapped teenagers, Brad Fulton, was played by an actor named Ted Eccles, E-C-C-L-E-S. And if you watch it and his voice sounds incredibly familiar to you, it's for good reason. He was a child actor, and he provided the iconic voice of Aaron, the title character in the timeless 1968 Rankin-Bass stop-motion holiday classic, The Little Drummer Boy.
What? What?
He's the voice. And he's
I never liked the Little Drummer Boy.
So I know. I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's still a fun fact.
It is a good incredibly fun fact.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I love those shrinkies. That's what the three teenagers are called, shrinkies. And of all the teenagers on all of the shows, I think I liked the shrinkies the best. Like, they were the most aspirational for me. They looked like teenagers in my neighborhood. And the girl shrinky, I can't remember what her name is, she was really sassy and funny. And I kind of wanted to
BJ,
be her.
BJ Masterson, but she was played by an actress named Susan Lawrence, who I don't think did a lot of other stuff because I really couldn't find anything on her. And she doesn't even have a hot link in Wikipedia.
Come on.
So there you go.
Sorry, Susan.
Yeah. Do better. Okay. So then coming in at number 7 is another craft show with three teenagers. And another one I think I would have really liked. And that's Wonderbug.
Sitting in a junkyard waiting to the ground up is a pile of cars.
Okay, so Wonderbug was in both the first and second season of the Kraft Super Show. And you guys, how lucky were we that the mid-70s were obsessed with magical talking, thinking vehicles?
Oh, my God, the Dune Buggy? Right. I know.
You've got the Love Bug, though. You've got Speed Buggy.
Yes.
We had all these magical vehicles, and it was so fun. And actually, the Kraft brothers explicitly designed Wonderbug to capture that exact Hanna-Barbera energy. So again, for those of you like me, did not watch, Wonderbug follows three teenagers, Susan, Barry, and Cece. And they find a beat up, rusted out dune buggy named Schlepcar in a junkyard. Do you guys want to know why they name it why it's called Schlepcar?
Sure, tell us.
Please, tell us.
Because it has a California personalized license plate that says Schlep. So that's why they just, I don't even know why they called it Schlep. Maybe because it's like that version of it is broken down and rusty and, you know, whatever.
They're schlepping from place to place.
Yeah. So the big twist in Wonderbug is that whenever they honk the special magical horn, that just kind of rusty, dilapidated Schlepcar instantly transforms into Wonderbug.
It's so shiny,
it's orange, high-flying, self-thinking superhero car. And then just sort of, this just reminds me of, they're like Scooby-Doo. Like, because every episode, the trio and Wonderbug, they're stumbling upon like crime rings and bank robbers and eccentric villains, right? But of course, Wonderbug always saves the day. He can fly. He's got all these gadgets that come out. And he has his own distinct personality, which is communicated entirely through cartoonish horn honking and wheel spinning. Wonderbug doesn't talk.
The spinning of the wheels. Yes.
So it's all just audio effects. But I think this is such a funny thing I stumbled upon. It says the audio effects were so distinct that kids on the playground in 1976 could instantly mimic the exact rhythm of Wonderbug's horn.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that cute? Yeah, it's sort of like Herbie the Love Bugs meet Scooby-Doo, right? Yeah. But with, the Sid and Marty Kraft stuff. The best to me are the, like, I'm using air quotes here, listeners, if you can't see, the special effects of when Wonderbug was flying. It's basically like I think even last week I might have said they were the first to use what was called blue screen technology. Mm-hmm. So you lose any of, like, the 3D-ness of it. So it's like them in a car, and someone is probably standing in front of them with, like, a fan, like a leaf blower thing. And they're all supposed to be, like, looking down.
Down at the floor.
What it looks like behind them is like someone like on, I don't even know, like rolled out like brown paper, butcher paper, painted a sky and clouds. But one of them, they're like, two of the teenagers are looking down like, he's down there. And the third one is just like looking off into the distance going, yeah, I see him. But he's not even looking down. It's so primitive. Okay, I have to tell you this. You guys are both going to love this. These two fun facts about two of those three teenagers, the two guys. So the man who played Barry's name was David Levy. You guys, he is now an American psychologist, professor, author, stage director, and actor. He's a professor of psychology at the Graduate School of Education and Psychology at Pepperdine University.
At Pepperdine, where they did Battle of the Network Stars.
That's right. Oh, wow.
I mean, he's the one who is the, like, sort of blondish hair, like Sandy Brown hair guy, okay? Mm-hmm. He's even co-authored a textbook on cross-cultural psychology and critical thinking. So that was just sort of a flash in the pan for him. Meanwhile, the other male actor, John Anthony Bailey, who played Cece, he was an American actor and pornographic film actor.
No.
Oh, no.
Want to see my Wonder Bug?
Yeah, shockingly, that was his porn name, Wonder Bug. No. He basically, after Wonder Bug, he transitioned into an adult film career. No, his stage name was Jack Baker. I wish it was funnier than that, though. I wish it was boring. Like Wonder Bug or, yeah. But and he died in 1994. But I just thought that was so interesting. He's like this children's TV actor.
There should be some kind of like rule that there has to be an amount of time that goes by before when you're a children's actor and then into the porn industry. There's a little moratorium on your acting.
It's like in your non-compete clause. Yeah, you can't do porn for 10 years.
Right after you did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At least. I just thought those two facts were so interesting.
That is funny. Yeah. Okay, what's in the number? What's in the number six spot, Carolyn?
Yes. So our next show, which aired from 1971 through 72, with again just one season, 17 episodes. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it just might be the absolute strangest of all the Croft creations, we know that that's saying a lot. It's Lidsville, which is an appropriate title for a show about a town filled with talking hats.
I don't understand.
Yes, that's what I said.
I don't understand.
Talking hats. Lidsville is the cookiest. Lidsville is the kickiest. Lidsville is the grooviest. Lidsville is a living end friend. If you get a chance to go there, you'll be glad you did. Cause everybody who goes to Lidsville really flips his lid. How's that for a topper?
I just want to know who, when someone was like, I got an idea for a show, and they present that. And I just want to see the room go, yes, yes.
Well, you know what? I think I have a little, interpretation of what I think may have happened in that little room that I am going to share with you guys. But I do want to say that I thought, okay, I've got Lidsville. I remembered Charles Nelson Reilly, but otherwise I didn't think I remembered it until I watched the opening scene.
Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh. I totally remember. I was humming along and singing some of the song with
you're kidding.
This is a recurring
story. This is a recurring story. We know all these shows.
We do. So anyway, I thought, I can only imagine what that pitch meeting was like. And so I thought I'd kind of tell you what my kind of idea of what it might have been like would be, So I see that Sid and Marty might waddle into some NBC exec's office and they say, gentlemen, Puffin Stuff was just the appetizer. Today, we are bringing you a world of hats, and we're calling it Lidsville. Okay, the premise is a teenage boy, which, by the way, was played by Butch Patrick, a.k.a. Eddie Munster, who you would not even recognize. Took me a little while to put two and two together because I had said last week that indeed that's who this was in this show, Butch Patrick. But there are no similarities to Eddie Munster in this, in Mark, the character. He's really cute. And
it's a lot of years later, right? From the
Munsters. Well, yes, it is. Okay. It is. But there's nothing remotely Eddie Munster-ish about him. He looks like he could have been on a cover of Tiger Beat. Perhaps he was. Yeah. And we are immediately introduced to him at, of all places, Six Flags Over Texas, where he is watching a magic show. Okay, just so you know, that's the thing. Now I'm going to move on. Here's the premise that Sid and Marty are pitching to the NBC execs. A teenage boy falls into a giant top hat and gets trapped in an alternate dimension populated entirely by walking, talking headwear. But the best part, you guys, of this whole pitch is going to be when they reveal the villain. They're going to say, or the execs are going to be expecting a witch. We're going from Witchy Poo. And Marty, I think he's just going to drop this ultimate bomb. Which witches are so 1969. The villain is Charles Nelson Reilly. that Match Game icon himself, and he will play the evil hoodoo, and he's going to be flying around in a motorized top hat called the Hatamaran. You guys, let me just tell you, this show is filled with more puns than you could even imagine. I think if it comes to what is the punniest show ever created, Lidsville is going to win that award. And I'll share some of those with you in just a little while. But you get the idea. It's a Hatamaran. Mm-hmm. Isn't that fun?
So cute.
I do want to tell you a little bit about some of the characters, some of the headwear that resides in Lidsville, because it's so funny. Their names are funny, and then their roles in the show are kind of funny. I've introduced you to Mark, that's Butch Patrick, and Horatio J. Hoodoo, that's Charles Nelson Reilly, our evil villain. And we have kind of a fun genie that wants to help Mark get out of this crazy Lidsville town. And this is Weenie the Genie, who I think Kristen mentioned before.
That might be my favorite name of Weenie all of the them. Genie.
And if you saw Weenie the Genie, you would immediately know that you've seen this show. Billy Hayes actually is the actress that plays.
Oh yeah, what else? She's done a lot Weenie of stuff, hasn't she?
Yes. Well, she was.
She was witchy poop.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So now she's a good guy because she's trying to help Mark get out of this awful town. Because you know, Mark, not only is he being like pursued by Horatio J. Hoodoo, Charles Nelson Reilly, he's also being pursued by Captain Hooknose. This is a pirate hat that literally has a hook in the place of a nose.
Oh my God.
Here's one of my favorite characters, Ra-Ra. Now, Ra-Ra is a football helmet and kind of has that dumb jock role. That's what Ra-Ra plays. Then there's Madam Ring-a-Ding. She is a party hat with a party favor nose, and she serves as Lidsville's social director. We've got Scorchy, a talking, walking fire hydrant with a long hose for a nose who wears, as you can guess it, a firefighter's hat. And he serves as Lidsville's warning system. So if anything bad's going to happen, Scorchy's going to let you know about it. We've got Tex, who is, as you can imagine, a cowboy hat. And his voice is one that's impersonating John Wayne. So indeed, we've got a walking, talking cowboy hat that sounds like John Wayne. We have got Tonsolini, who is an opera singing hat and sings every line of his dialogue. And lastly, we have Bruce Hoodoo. And Bruce Hoodoo is not a hat, but is the twin brother of Horatio J. Hoodoo. Oh. Can we just take a moment for the 70s to just say there were a lot of twins, in our shows. That looked exactly like the other person.
It's the
like
same Bewitched. Person. And then they're saying that it's a long lost cousin or a twin that we never knew about. So many twins.
Right. And it's it's the same actor playing both roles.
So Charles Nelson Reilly was also, what was his name? Bruce Hoodoo?
Bruce Hoodoo was the twin brother, Horatio. What I love the most is, as you can guess it, the puns. If it had hat, bonnet, topper, lid, brim, crown, headpiece, any of those, let's make it a joke. That's what they did. So you can imagine all the, keep it under your hat. I'll eat my hat. Mad as a hatter. Hats off to you. Top that. That's a joke often aimed at the top hats. You're talking through your hat. That's old hat. At the drop of a hat. I'll put a lid on it. What's under your lid? Can you imagine? I would just be so happy just sitting in a writer's room with people just batting those back and forth.
I love that.
I would have literally told you that not only did I not see this show, I would have told you I've never heard of this show.
Same. Until you described it.
I don't think I knew the name of it. Like I
didn't know the name of it.
But
no
as
idea.
Soon as I saw the scene, he's like sitting in, those like theater areas of those amusement parks. You're sitting on like a cement bench. And so, and Charles Nelson Reilly is this magician at Six Flags. And then somehow Mark / Eddie Munster wanders into Charles's dressing room. And this hat, the magician's hat, all of a sudden becomes giant. And he goes to look in. And as you can imagine, he topples in and heads to Lidsville. And the rest is history.
So. I still don't see how that survives in a pitch meeting. It's too crazy. And yet, here we are.
Yeah.
Talking about it. And it's history. It's TV history.
Although I also wonder if by then, Sid and Marty Krofft would just kind of buy anything that they were pitching.
Yeah, maybe.
Because they had been so successful and,
But were they? Because every time we talk about a show, it's one season.
Yeah.
And then there's another one.
17 episodes.
Yes. Always.
But at the same time, they're also, casting, not, so, I mean, people that are recognizable
oh,
or that
yes,
go
every
on
show.
To.
Yes,
yeah, so
show.
There's something going on there. And it was the 70s. Can we just say
yeah.
it was the 70s? So yep. I think that answers a lot of what, what you know, well, we can't imagine would get greenlit.
Right.
Greenlit.
Well, right. And we can use that. I mean, and how many episodes do we have now? 270-something. We use it was the 70s for right. many, many, many of the things we talk about.
And maybe they weren't canceled. Maybe they were just like on to the next thing. I'm making yeah. an assumption that you keep going until you're canceled. And so I'm like, why is every single show one season? But they had one season of shows throughout the whole 70s.
Right.
How many, look at all these different shows. So people were continuing to greenlight them. They wouldn't continue to greenlight them if they continually got canceled.
No?
So
yeah.
maybe their right. creative energy was just so manic that they couldn't mm-hmm. stick with one thing for longer than a season.
I can totally envision that.
Yeah.
And they obviously made a mark on us. So, you know, they're classics to us.
They are classics, even if you think you've never heard of it.
Yeah, that's right. That Who cares what the title is?
Hi, everybody. Let's pause here because I want to tell you about two books that we've been reading. As you know, the three of us are always on the lookout for books with nostalgic vibes, and we had two land on our desk this week from best-selling author of many other sexy, messy, sort of erotic suspense novels, Kate Stewart. It's a duology, and they have to be read together. The first one is called Drive. That's out now. And the sequel, Reverse, is coming soon. So here's the funny part. The nostalgia we're talking about is the early 2000s. That's nostalgia now, people. And I'm really trying to wrap my head around it. So Drive follows a music journalist who's torn between two men. It's an angsty, steamy, rock star romance with a killer 2000s playlist. Okay, you had me at playlist, right? And the story will continue with Reverse. And in this one, the next generation uncovers secrets from the past and finds their own love story and their own playlist. The songs are important, and each chapter opens with a song that you'll remember and love. These books are for people who like Colleen Hoover, and they are spicy, you guys. They are sizzling, high, high spice. So if you're into sexy, spicy, dark rock star romances with a playlist, check them out. Drive is out now, and Reverse is coming soon.
Okay, in our number five spot is everyone's favorite bug band.
The Bugaloos. The Bugaloos, we're in the air and everywhere, flying high, flying loose, flying free as a summer breeze, happy as a summer breeze.
The Bugaloos aired on NBC from 1970 to 1972, and it was in syndication from 1978 to 1985. So the
wow.
Bugaloos are well known to both Gen Xers and millennials. There is today, at this moment in time, a long-standing website devoted to the Bugaloos called Bugaloos.net. It is active today. That's how wow. beloved the show is.
Yes.
There's fan art, collectibles. There's Bugaloos trivia. You can download PDFs of the three Bugaloos novels from this website.
Ooh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is really cool. Well, maybe some of those things we'll put in this month's weekly reader.
Oh, that would be
so
hilarious.
That you have links
yes.
to go straight there. Yeah.
And there's a whole page devoted to tracking the Bugaloos buggy. The Bugaloos had a dune buggy with wings because it
of
is
course.
Also a bug. Yes.
Yeah.
And should we also have an episode that is devoted to dune buggies and flying cars of the 70s?
I mean, that would be really fun.
I think so. I think we could populate an entire episode with all the dune buggies. So there's on this website, there's a whole chronology of where this car is. Where is the buggy, what is it called? The Bugaloos buggy. Where is the Bugaloos buggy? I can't even say it. Anyway.
Tongue twister.
At one point, it was found in a storage unit in France. And then someone from London bought it. Then it was in the London Motor Museum. And then it went missing. And they're like, where is the Bugaloos buggy? And then they found it. And then there's a new owner. They report every time there's a new owner of the Bugaloos buggy. It's hilarious.
Wow.
Okay, so the show takes place in Tranquility Forest. And the basic premise is that there are these people bugs. They're people, but they have wings and antenna. Otherwise, they're people. And they are in a band. Their names are Joy, IQ, Harmony, and Courage. I didn't know they had names. I had no idea. And what I never picked up on was that they were actual bugs, not just generic bugs. Like the girl bug, Joy, she's a butterfly. And the three boys are a grasshopper, a bumblebee, and a ladybug, which I think is funny. Why did they make Hippy the ladybug?
You go, Crofts.
And the thing about the Bugaloos is that they can fly, and they're really good at playing music. And this drives Martha Ray crazy. Martha Ray is the actress who plays Bizarre Bonita. Bizarre Bonita cannot fly, and she is talentless. And so every show is about Bizarre Bonita trying to either sabotage or steal the talent from the Bugaloos. Bonita lives in a giant jukebox. She has a horrible voice, and she's jealous. Martha Ray is made up in true Croft fashion, meaning outrageous. She has crazy hair, crazy prosthetics, lots of glitter and paint on her face. She's like a pink witchy poo with a pink afro made out of feathers. And if we could have seen through all this makeup and prosthetics, we would have seen a serial Love Boat guest. She was the one who looked slightly familiar, but we didn't know why. It's because she's on the Bugaloos, Martha Ray. So the Bugaloos was actually pitched as the British version of the Monkees. That's what they wanted this show to be. If you recall.
I'm sorry. Yeah, let's just make them bugs.
Yes, they're bugs. They're the Monkees, but let's make them bugs.
That's right.
Remember, all of these kids had British accents. Again, I never noticed. And thousands of teenagers showed up to audition for the show in England in the spring of 1970, including Phil Collins.
What?
Two of the three finalists for the role of the grasshopper were Phil Collins, pre-Genesis, and the guy who would go on to manage this emerging artist named Elton John. So the third guy got the part, and he has said that if he had not gotten the part, it would have changed the trajectory of the history of rock and roll.
Oh, my God. No kidding.
Right? You are not kidding.
They're talking about Genesis. The butterfly effect, and the grasshopper effect. Maybe let's start calling it the grasshopper effect.
There's another little interesting fact about a member of the Collins family. It is Phil Collins' mother who discovered Jack Wild of H.R. Puffin Stuff fame. Yes, she saw him in a park playing with his brother, and she helped him get his Artful Dodger job, and then that's where Marty Croft saw him and wanted him on H.R. Puffin Stuff. But Phil Collins' mother was a talent agent, so perhaps that's
so
how
glad.
Phil
I missed that
got,
part because I was like, "What? She's
yeah,
just like,
oh, yeah, sorry,
know, that's
sorry, everyone
in the park."
Yes, so she was
okay,
a talent agent.
Got it.
She, but so maybe that's how Phil got his little foot in
she
the door to
like,
try out for the Bugaloos.
Philip, I see there's an audition today.
Yes, and I know the Croft brothers.
Mm-hmm. You guys, seriously, listeners,
I can't do
you're
an
welcome.
Accent.
You are welcome for all of this. These fun facts that we you know give you. Every
Phil
week.
Collins could have been a Bugaloo. So just like all these other shows, the Bugaloos only ran for 17 episodes. Here we are. There's a whole fandom. There's a whole website devoted to the Bugaloos. Only 17 episodes. How do you get years of reruns out of 17 episodes? But they had the intention of making another season. They really did. But there was a miscommunication with the actors, and they accidentally went home to the UK. And that's what killed the second season. I'm like, how can't you just bring him back? Just come back.
Yeah. Yes.
There was air travel then.
Yeah. And there was also supposed to be a Bugaloos movie. There was a Bugaloos movie in the works, but they accidentally went home. So they're like,
oh, well, never mind.
Well, guess we're canceled. Guess we can't record anymore.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Coming in at number four is perhaps the Croft show that is closest to my heart. Part Batman, part Charlie's Angels, and all Croft, I'm talking about Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. Another theme that when you listen to it or hear it, you're going to be singing and humming right along. It will come right back to you.
Mm-hmm. Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, fighting all evil deeds. Each writes for a magazine, hiding the life she leads.
I loved this so much. So if you remember, we have Electra Woman, Deidre Hall. By day, she's Lori, working as a level-headed reporter for the Newsmaker magazine. But by superhero time, she is the undisputed leader of the duo, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. Dinah Girl, by day, is Judy, a teenage sidekick who helps along as a reporter at the Newsmaker magazine. But by superhero time, she is Dinah Girl. And think Batman and Robin, we got Electra Woman and Dinah Girl.
that'll help you. All right, here's where my memory comes in, okay? If you guys recall, they, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, they had to become Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. They had to go through the Electra change, which was when they went into this like space and then
menopause.
Yes.
I was just about to say, I think I went through that about 3 years ago.
And go from their, you know, reporter clothes to that bright spandex that made them who we loved, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. And they had the Electracoms. If you remember those,
oh, yeah.
They were the bulky wrist devices that could do just about everything. Yes, yes. And you could talk into it. And
they weren't giant. It was like a basket of strawberries on your wrist.
Yes,
it was the world's biggest Apple Watch.
Well, let me tell you, right around this exact time, McDonald's had its McWristwatches that came out.
Fucking Donald's.
I said McFucking Donald's. I didn't mean to, but that's how it came out.
I just I think of it as a negative, but I guess if they're stealing, I don't know. But of course, Ronnie and I had our McWristwatches.
You did?
So, of course. And so, we're going to play Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. And we're going to talk into our watches and we're going to fight crime in Katy, Texas, because there was a lot of it. So I have such distinct memories.
In the cul-de-sac.
End up talking into my wrist on my
wristwatch.
Yeah,
that was
like a TV. It was like a little TV on their wrist. And you could do the Electra beam. You could get any
bad
guy
with your
Electra.
It was like this mini computer.
It's an Apple Watch.
It's an Apple Watch.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was the prototype because all the things you could do.
The other day, my daughter called and I didn't have my phone with me and it rang, my wrist rang. And I know this has been, you could do this for years. I feel like I'm on Get Smart when I'm like on a walk and I'm talking to my daughter in my wrist.
You want
to
pick up your shoe?
I literally feel like I'm a Jetson. Yeah.
You need to be like, Electra Woman here. How can I help you?
I will. Yeah, next time.
But yes, it could do all the things. It could do, it could create the Electra Beam, the Electra Force, the Electra Force Shield. If you had any special power, if you put Electra in front of it, they could do it. Everything was their Electra car, which of course could also become a flying vehicle. All of the Croft vehicles could go on land and then they could fly.
I think I'm Electra bitch. I'm Electra bitchy.
There, I can believe it. No offense. But what's so interesting.
I'm sure none taken.
None taken.
And this is for I think almost all the shows we've talked about, one, this was only 8 episodes. The impression it left on me for only being 8 episodes, and you guys, these are only like 12-minute episodes. Because if you remember, on these super shows, there are like 2. You might get Electra Woman and Lidsville, or, you know, Dr. Shrinker. So they're not even like 30-minute full episodes that we're watching. It is this like 10 to 12-minute
And there were
show.
Only 8 episodes.
There were only 8
series?
Episodes in 1976
so how many
of
times
Electra
did
Woman
we see
and Dinah
those?
Girl. It's insane.
We must have seen them 10 times each.
I guess so. And I think too for us, you know, this is the same era of Wonder Woman, we're going to get the Bionic Woman, we're going to get Charlie's Angels, like for girls, these are our, you know, really some but our superheroes.
It was groundbreaking for the ladies. On the shag carpet watching TV, Electra Woman, Dinah Girl. Like, there's no, I know that boys understand this, but I just have to reiterate what it was like to what, and it's better than Catwoman. It was better than Catwoman. It's better than Batwoman or Batgirl.
They were the stars. They were these supporting players or something.
It was huge. It was so, so huge.
It deserves its spot.
Yeah, it sure does. Okay, we're getting down to it, you guys. We're coming up for our top 3, the 3 most popular Croft shows. In the number 3 spot is the show that I chose as my favorite quote-unquote cartoon in our Saturday morning cartoons episode called Saturday Morning Fever. I do cartoon in quotes because this is live action. It's not a cartoon, but I didn't know what to call it. If I had a vote, I would have put this show at number 1. That's how much I love Sigmund and the Sea Monsters.
Sigmund, you are a rotten sea monster.
Sigmund, you're through.
Scram! Get out of here.
I love that little sea monster.
Oh,
I love
so
him.
Cute.
I love how they hold his tentacle when they cross the street. I love how Johnny and Scott take care of him so lovingly, like hiding him in their clubhouse so he's safe. Because everyone has a clubhouse. In the 70s, we all had a clubhouse. On TV, everyone had a clubhouse. and they would keep him away from his awful, terrible sea monster family who have rejected him. They kicked him out of the cave because he won't scare a human. They kicked him out. Johnny, of course, was played by Johnny Whitaker, who played Jody on Family Affair, and Scott is his little brother and looks more like Cousin Oliver than Johnny Whitaker. But no matter, no matter. These are the boys who find Sigmund on the beach and hide him in the clubhouse, and they live with Zelda, their hyper-vigilant housekeeper, because this is the 70s and everyone is an orphan. Right. And after Johnny and Scott and after Johnny and Scott find Sigmund on the beach at Dead Man's Point and bring him back to live in their clubhouse, this show becomes a series of capers about keeping Sigmund hidden. Because if Zelda sees him, she will call the dog catcher or something. We don't know, but it won't be good. And so when Zelda goes to the grocery store, then Sigmund can come out of the clubhouse for fun and secret shenanigans and whatnot. He might even come into the house. And then there's so many near misses, like, Sigmund, get out of here. Someone's coming. And then little Sigmund has to run away, but he can't run because he has tentacles instead of legs. And so that's why there's so much falling down. Sigmund falls down all the time. And then Johnny and Scott will run. They're right there, and they pick him up. And they're holding him by the tentacles, and they're hustling him into a hiding place, into a closet, or back into the clubhouse. Basically, Sigmund is another iteration of Snuffleupagus. There's lots
kind?
Of,
yeah.
He was right here. I saw him with my own eyes. But Johnny and Scott, they each grab a tentacle and they whisk him away. And they're like, I didn't see anything. There was no, I don't know what you're talking about. I think this watching over Sigmund and picking him up and helping him be safe and have a nice life, along with the music that we talked about in our last episode, a.k.a. Johnny Whitaker strumming a guitar with no strings and lip-syncing to songs about friendship. I think these are the reasons. This is the reason that I love the show, because Johnny and Scott were so attentive to little Sigmund. There's so much caretaking. They're like little daddies. And in that Saturday morning TV episode that I just referenced, I point out how Sigmund is essentially parentless because his parents are the sea monster version of Archie Bunker. They kicked him out of the cave, yes. But right. Sigmund has also emancipated himself from his parents, and Johnny and Scott support him in this decision, and they protect him from his nasty family, especially his brothers Slurp and Glurp, who are like malevolent Gomer Piles. They fall down a lot, too. Everybody's falling down. So Sigmund is an orphan, and coincidentally, Johnny and Scott are also orphans. They live with their housekeeper. And I always wonder, like, why the 70s made everyone an orphan? Why did Johnny and Scott have to live with their housekeeper?
Why couldn't it have been, like, a grandma or an aunt?
A neighbor? Why couldn't they just live with their parents? Like, what's wrong with that? I don't understand. Why did the 70s do this to us? I don't know why, but I think we should devote another episode to the orphans of the 70s. Like Buffy and Jody.
Yes.
So Jody was an orphan twice.
Oh,
Johnny Whitaker was an orphan twice on Family Affair and on Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. So that's Sigmund and the Sea Monsters in the number 3 spot. I love you, Sigmund.
Well, I have one other fun fact for Sigmund. If you remember last week, we talked a little bit about an actress who has a kind of a recurring role in Sigmund. She's the one who has the dog named Fluffy or Muffy. I think Fluffy, who kind of Sigmund falls in love with her dog, yeah. Fluffy. I can almost hear the voice in my head as I'm thinking of it. She was the voice of Fern in Charlotte's Web.
I can hear that voice too. Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes. So, and I get that's also Lucy Van Pelt in some of the Peanuts.
Yes.
So
she was Fern and Lucy.
Okay, coming in at number 2.
This is big.
This is very big. This is my introduction to the world of Croft. Not only mine, but the world's introduction to the Crofts. This would be H.R. Puffin Stuff, premiering in 1969, and with the tagline, "What if a giant talking dragon mayor helped a little boy trapped on a magical island while a cackling witch tried to steal his talking flute?" That sums it up.
I want that on
and
a t-shirt.
And also, as I mentioned last week, it's where my fear or whatever, just heebie-jeebiness of talking inanimate objects began. And I
right now want to say I really am thinking about filing a workman's comp thing for this issue and the research I've had to do, because it's really been a little bit triggering for me.
This week has been a lot for you, Caroline.
Yeah. It has. There are a lot of things that, particularly about H.R. Puffin stuff, because as we know, the main character, Jack Wilde, and he plays Jimmy. He's marooned on this island, but it's not just any island. It's the Living Island, where everything, okay, everything talks, sings, dances, and, you know, is basically alive. So we're talking trees, we're talking, you know, vultures, everything that shouldn't be, it's. And so there you go. That's where I think, as I said before, my fear of all of this stuff was maybe planted.
And if you think about it, they were children in 1939 when The Wizard of Oz came out, where we get the Wicked Witch of the West and those monkeys, those flying monkeys, and the trees that talk. Is that their original inspiration?
I think you might be onto something.
I think so. Boom.
Gosh, and we can't ask them, which is so sad.
They've died.
But yeah, I think because there are a lot of similarities. And then you think about Witchy Poo. She, it's kind of almost like a bikey kind of contraption. Like her vehicle is also one that flies.
Oh my God. Yes, she's on a bike in the sky.
Yeah. I think there's a lot. And we probably are just now putting two and two together.
Literally in this moment. We're figuring this out.
And one of the interesting things that I didn't realize, but again, was maybe a nod to adults. We talked a little bit about this, or we talked a little bit about this last week, how the Crofts could kind of slip in some of that stuff that would have been maybe over our head, but our parents might have said, oh, that's kind of funny, because a lot of these characters on Living Island were actually voiced in parodies of like famous film stars such as Mae West, John Wayne, Edward G. Robinson. So our parents maybe walking through the room would have been like, oh, but, we wouldn't have known, but you know,
they were like mimicking icons
exactly.
That our parents knew and recognized. We had no idea and we didn't care. But that was their nod to our parents.
Right. And again, this was a show that was only lasted one season. It wasn't canceled, actually, and it was offered a second season, but the Crofts had to put in so much of their own money for the production of it that they were losing money on it, and they just couldn't afford to have a second season because whatever they were being offered monetarily was not going to cover their costs. So that's kind of how they did the film version, and Kellogg's cereal kind of went in on that adventure or whatever, that collaboration, and they were part of that making that film. But indeed, it could have gone on, but it was the Croft brothers who chose to have it just end at that one season, which again is amazing to us that it only lasted one season because of the impact and the memories we have about it. Not only that, in 2007, TV Guide ranked it as number 27 on their all-time list of cult TV shows.
Yes.
Totally. So,
yes.
It lives on and on. It has a Funko Pop line. So you can get H.R. Puffin stuff, Witchy Poo, and Kling and Klang, those like Keystone Copy kind of characters that were in the show. They have, they have little Funko Pop characters.
Which I thought was from McDonald's.
Yeah.
It's all getting
very funny. That is really McDonald's. Yes. That is super obvious. Like, did they think they were going to win that case?
I can't believe it. How on earth did they think they were going to get away with that?
And how did those employees that jumped shift or whatever from Croft and went to McDonald's, how did they sleep at night?
Yeah.
Well, and how did they not specifically get sued, right?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Gosh. Well, a couple fun facts. One is one that Michelle already shared with us about that whole lawsuit that changed everything, really, because in advertising, it was really the first major case that had a landmark ruling about character infringement and intellectual property. So they're probably studied in law schools. They're probably like the case Croft versus McDonald's.
H.R. Puffin stuff versus Mayor McCheese.
That's right.
That's real. That is so significant.
Well, can you imagine that? The courtroom? Will the plaintiff rise?
They just nod their
HR
hamburger heads.
Puff and Stuff stands up, and then you just see Mayor McCheese with his giant head bowed as they read the verdict.
And the other interesting fact, which could have changed a career, was that there were only two people that auditioned for the role of Witchy Poo. One was Billy Hayes, who got the role. And the other person was Penny Marshall.
Oh,
no
my
way.
God.
Yes. What? And they liked her, but they said at the end that she really was not right for the role. And Sid jokingly would say, we just couldn't have a Brooklyn witch. And that was, at the end of the day, why they decided Penny Marshall wasn't the right.
That would
but
be
also,
much more
you talk about the grasshopper effect, or that now we can call it maybe the HR effect. You think, had she been cast, one thing, just that one little difference in her life might not have then led to things like Laverne and Shirley all these other things. You just don't know.
Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Crazy.
Because think about Billie Hayes. I mean, she was always Witchy Poo, or kind of just a creepy-ish character.
Yeah.
So if we... You know, I don't think I would have bought her as Laverne because I would always have had this icky feeling. Yeah. Same with Margaret Hamilton when she did like those Folgers commercials. I'm sorry, she was still the Wicked Witch of the West.
Yeah, buying Folgers. I'm not doing it.
No, I'm sorry. No. Never
I don't want scary coffee.
Not on my watch, people.
Well, and you can see how Penny Marshall would have made that, she would have made that witch. I would have liked her better, truthfully. It would have been a different witch.
It's more
she
of a character.
Been, like, yeah, more of a like harumph.
Right, exactly.
She's like a Brooklyn. She's just complaining all the time.
Yeah, whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Lastly, I want to ask you guys, Kristen, you talked last week about the music from some of these shows. And there is one particular song that I just wanted to ask you if you guys remember from HR Puff and Stuff. So I'm going to play it for you quickly. If you remember the Three Oranges, the performance.
Ooh, that's us.
Ooh. Here they are, the Three Oranges.
Come on, Buster, and watch a real act.
Sorry, is that good?
Oranges, sponges, who said?
Oranges, sponges, who said?
Oranges, sponges, who said?
There ain't no rhyme for oranges. Do you guys remember that?
I don't know.
It's when she and her two little vulture friends come out, and they're not Witchy Poo and the vultures. They're the Three Oranges in this talent show. And she's wearing like those big kind of clown sunglasses, and they're orange. And she's got like an orange cape on. And then she falls at the end, and it's revealed that she's Witchy
Poo. I can picture Witchy
Poo. You probably
in
would
all of
recognize
that,
sure. Yes. Yeah. But it's the whole thing with, you know, who says there's nothing that rhymes with orange? And then she does a whole verse on like smorges, smoranges. Who says nothing rhymes with oranges? And they do their little ditty. So
oh my God,
that's very
love that.
Clever.
That's
yes,
very clever.
Very clever. As we know, the Croft brothers are.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Oranges, smorges, who said? Oranges, smorges, who said? Oranges, smorges, who said? There ain't no rhyme for oranges.
All right, well, then that leads us to number one, and I think that's a no-brainer, right?
Should
we have a drum roll? Let's
have
a drum roll.
Right now is doing, it's like being at a concert when the encore is like, what if they not played yet? What if
I know, right? Yeah. All right, well, here we go. Drum roll, please. Coming in at number one with the most votes by far is Land of the Lost. And you guys, let's just add that to our list of generation titles. We're the Land of the Lost generation, proudly. Mm-hmm. And Land of the Lost, as we all know, it originally aired on Saturday mornings. Like for me and my sister, this was a Saturday morning staple from 1974 to 1976 on, Carolyn, the NBC television network. Interestingly, though, CBS used it as a summer replacement in 1985, from 1985 to 1987. And I mean... just the very definition of cult classic with all these other shows, you know, that we're talking about. Land of the Lost stars our pal, the great, funny, charming, engaging Wesley Uhr, Kathy Coleman, Spencer Milligan, and Philip Paley. And instead of me giving you a little synopsis, let's let Wesley do it. And you guys, this is coming straight from our episode with him.
Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition met the greatest earthquake ever known. High on the rapids, it struck their tiny raft. Ah! Plunged them down 1,000 feet below to the Land of the Lost, to the Land of the Lost. And then Grumpy goes, roar!
Yes, that's right. They are trapped in the land of the lost with only the minimal camping equipment they had on their raft. But what that catchy theme song doesn't tell you is how they then must avoid becoming a snack for a T-Rex they name Grumpy. You guys, that's something my daughters would have named a T-Rex.
Oh, yeah.
Grumpy. Yeah. While they live in their very high-tech cave, and that is a joke because it literally looks like the cave on Dr. Shrinker, yeah. And that it was made with some paper mache, yeah. Mm-hmm. And if dodging dinosaurs wasn't enough, they also have to contend with the Pakuni, the hairy primitive cave dwellers. Chaka is the famous one who they actually befriend, played by young Philip Haley. And most famously terrifying, the Sleestaks. Who basically look like giant, happy green iguanas in turtleneck sweaters. Yes. It is the ultimate 1970s fever dream, where basically high concept sci-fi meets very low budget rubber monster suits. And I want to give you some just fun facts. And I got these mostly from our great episode with Wesley Ure. Go back to 2023. I will also have, this will be in our monthly weekly reader. Those of you who are already subscribers, you know that we have links to related episodes to all of our episodes. And that episode with Wesley Ure is linked in our weekly reader, but you can also go back and find that. I got my information from that, from Wesley himself, and also from Remind Magazine. Don't forget remindmagazine.com/pop for a year subscription, only $12. Anyway, you guys might remember this from that conversation. Even though the Croft brothers conceived Land of the Lost, they didn't write it. They didn't write the story Bible. They didn't write the specifics of the plot. That fell to former Star Trek writer David Gerrold. He guided that show through all three seasons, and he also recruited other science fiction authors like Larry Niven and Norman Spinrad to help him out, which was pretty big stuff then. He says that Sid Croft had put together a book of pictures that he cut out from the covers of various science fiction magazines. Like, this is my idea. And he handed it to them. And some of the pictures, they were just things like a waterfall, a jungle, a giant bee, dinosaurs, monkey people, you know, this type of stuff. And they said, here, look, this is our vision. Can you make this into a TV series? They had the title, but that was pretty much it. And David Gerrold went on to write a script that included all of it, which was pretty cool.
The other thing that is interesting is that you said this ran for three seasons. And now that we've talked about every single one of these shows, is that the longest running show?
I bet, yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet it is. Well, another thing, another interesting fact that I know we also learned from Wesley is that Land of the Lost, really, when it debuted, it came with a fully functional language, foreign language, which is spoken by the Pakunis. And the Crofts actually thought that this language within the show would make it more educational. But I love how it's just like nonsense. However, they hired UCLA linguistics professor Victoria Frompton to invent a language.
Oh my God.
And she was an expert in West African languages. So she drew from a language spoken in Ghana, which is called A-K-A-N. I just don't want to, it's a con, a can, but A-K-A-N. She created 200 words for the Pakuni. She developed this language basically so that children watching could slowly learn it over the course of the show. So that when Chaka's talking, maybe by end of season two, children, you know, who we know are little sponges, they might go, I know what he's saying. Because it was an actual, they didn't just every time come up with nonsense words. This was a language she created.
I wonder if anybody knows any Pakuni words. I mean, I don't, I did not absorb it that way.
If you're listening, if you do, let us know.
If you speak Pakuni.
If you speak Pakuni.
What's all the noise?
Ka! Sa!
Chaka! Yeba!
Jeremini!
Yeba!
And then we know, we've talked about this fact before, but it's so fun. We're going to mention it one more time. So we know the Sleestaks. They're famously tall, right? Mm-hmm. You know who else is generally tall? Carolyn, who else is? Who are people that are generally tall?
Basketball players are usually on the taller side.
Ding, ding, ding. You're right. High school basketball players, which is why the producers of the show, they reached out to Palos Verdes High School, which was very close to where they were filming, to see if any of their more, you know, vertically gifted students wanted a role. And one high schooler who took them up on it was future NBA star...
Bill Walton.
Bill Laimbeer.
Oh, Laimbeer. Oh, sorry.
Thought... Bill Laimbeer. Maybe Walton did too. I don't know, but Bill Laimbeer did. He was 6'11".
Oh my God.
You guys. Mm-hmm. And he was in high school.
Wow.
He was 18 years old. He played. He was a SleaStack before he left for college at Notre Dame, where he began that basketball career that would see him play 11 seasons with the Detroit Pistons and then later become a WNBA coach. He says, a quote from him says, it was easy money. People on TV only work 20 minutes out of a whole day. It was a lot of fun and a good experience, especially when you were 18 years old. I just think that's so fun to that's know. And funny. And I remember Wesley told us that sometimes between takes and like when it was a lunch break, it was so much of a pain for them to get out of those SleaStack costumes. But you would see them, they would take that like the helmet, like the head off. But from the neck down, they were still SleaStack. And they would just be walking around carrying like the head under their arm or sometimes shooting baskets.
Oh, gosh.
Think that would be a great photo.
Out there right now, there are people out there who were SleaStacks. And imagine you're at like an offsite for work and there's like a team building exercise. Like, tell us something we don't know about you. Like,
two truths and a lie.
I was a SleaStack.
Oh, my God. That would be a great two truths and a lie, Carolyn. Yeah. So we, Land of the Lost, well-deserved first place. Let's all give it a round of applause. Yep. Good job. Or let's all give it a hiss.
That's it, you guys. Your favorite Croft fever dream was Land of the Lost, even though you still have nightmares about SleaStacks. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for caring about giant foam puppet things and the role that they played in the culture of the Gen X childhood. That's all we have for you today. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
And to everyone supporting us on Patreon, thank you. Your generosity keeps the lights on and the memories rolling. And because of you, we get to keep doing this fun job that we have. We get to keep revisiting the songs, the movies, the cultural touchstones that helped raise us. And it means more than we can say that you choose to spend your time and a little bit of your money keeping this Gen X conversation alive. Today, we're giving a special shout out to these patrons: Laura, Shannon, Jen, Teresa, Dawn, Melissa, Annabelle, Sandra, Rosa, Christy, Jenny, Sherry, Nina, and the Dead Sleep Podcast. That's so fun when another podcast, we're all on this together. And that is one that we love. So if you guys have trouble falling asleep at night, plug that in your ears.
Indeed. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Threesome. Three's what? courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers. The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.
Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did.